Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 101, where Tom, Catherine, and Miranda are discussing the book, The Motivation to Work, by Frederick Hertzberg, Bernard Mausner, and Barbara Snyderman, published in 1959 by Wiley. In part two, we will discuss some of the challenges of identifying motivation and hygiene factors and establishing policies and strategies to improve both workplace climate and performance. If you missed part one, please visit our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. So we concluded part one, talking about some important hygiene factors, diversity inclusion being a very significant one, and one that's very active in the current discourse. One of the things that has struck me in the conversation that Hertzberg's study really brought up to me is that, like salary, DEI or DEIB, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, which is has emerged as sort of like the next step, is something that has both kind of like motivational and hygiene aspects, depending on who you are or where you are in the organization at the given time. So it struck me as one that can be like the salary, as one that can do both depending on the context of what we're talking about. And to give you an example, in a conversation that I was having with a colleague, there's definitely the hygiene factor, which has traditionally been there. We want, discrimination, inequity. Those are all things that obviously have no place in the workplace. The organization needs to work to get rid of them. But their elimination doesn't necessarily immediately translate into greater satisfaction, because there is still the need in order for people to feel not just included in the workplace, but also productive in the workplace. Like there should be some accomplishment that comes out of it. So obviously from the hygiene perspective, it's a very, very important, and this is an initiative or a series of initiatives that aim to try to improve that. But part of the challenge comes in also with respect to how it's thought of between managers and workers. There's a study that came out very, very recently, and I think it was Harvard Business Review, that shows sort of like a difference in perspective between how DEIB programs are perceived by the management versus how they're perceived by the workers. And the gulf between their perspectives is significant. Of course, the managers are more likely to think that their programs are working successfully to address or to inform workers about the DEIB programs that they have in the organization and the sense that they're eliminating some of these problems from the workplace, whereas the workers have the opposite perspective, complete opposite perspective. They think that nothing's changed. Things are still the way they are. My reaction to that in the form of like a series of questions is, how much or to what extent is perhaps the managers' and the workers' perspectives biased, because these are self-reported surveys, of course, biased on the basis of where they are in the organization? Is there some sort of a bias by which the one who's running the program is going to want to report that their program is having a greater impact than it really has? On the other end, are the workers biased because of they feel a little bit less secure in the workplace and therefore are intending to bias their answers a little bit more in the negative, which would then sort of suggest that participant observation or some other method would probably give a more accurate picture of what's really going on with the effects with these kinds of programs trying to improve the workplace. I hope that all makes sense.
So should equity, if that is all-encompassing enough of a term across all of that, be a hygiene factor for 2023?
Make sure I understand your question. Is that, do you think that's a legitimate hygiene factor? Is that what you're asking?
Should it be added to the list?
Yeah, it would. Diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging do strike me as four interrelated but different factors. What are each of those four represent in terms of things we want organizations to be rid of. Diversity is obvious. We want to get rid of homogeneity. We want to get rid of systemic bias, unconscious bias and discrimination, which also kind of applies to inclusion as well. Human dignity, respect, equity. We're trying to get rid of inequitable treatment. Belonging is maybe I'm just not as current on the conversation of exactly what it is doing.
My understanding of this conversation applied to Hertzberg's work is that the factors that he conceptualized within these studies in a certain era, in a certain sort of research setting, by definition today need tweaks, need variations, or need to be at least open to differences within them. So perhaps if I'm talking about a workforce which is diverse, the achievement, the recognition, that meaning of that thing needs to be different for the various people that are in the workforce. That was my understanding. At the same time, belonging, I feel it's more related to the cohesion or the inclusion, the social elements of that workforce. So to a certain extent, possibly it's a little bit difficult to have a general conversation, but I feel that there is value in considering Hertzberg's factors, but then introducing elements of variation, and I would see that working. And perhaps if his studies were done or were repeated with today's makeup of the workforce, maybe you would already have those variations. So it's really also this temporal element of having done them in those settings and then trying to perhaps extend them. And I think the diversity inclusion elements sort of already bring that into the equation.
Can I ask, Ad, if we were to bring things to 2023 and what we would perhaps suggest as hygiene factors or motivators, very kind of controversially, could I say motivator is fear? You know, we don't hear much about fear as motivation in the study at all. And, you know, maybe it's not a motivator for good work or high levels of productivity, but it is a motivator. And I didn't see it there.
It is, and perhaps it's also different depending on the people that you're talking to. So if I'm talking to somebody who's quite well established or very confident, they wouldn't perhaps fear losing their job, or perhaps they know that they're just going to land on their feet. And I think fear induces different mechanisms because of that difference in perceiving fear. And I would also say that the sense of pride is different. So it's not named as pride, but I do see a lot of the achievement recognition to be elements that can easily be connected to pride. And again, similarly to fear. There is that different element, but also, I don't know, I think perhaps today's workforce, or at least certain pockets of it, there may also be a gender element to it. I hope, or at least I'm actually trying to work towards that. Understanding that work and happiness and satisfaction around work is really just one piece of the entire puzzle for how this study is set up. It feels like it's one source of satisfaction and that's it, which was part of the research objectives, and that's absolutely fine. But if you look at some of the mental health conditions that are listed, some of the really dark ones, including drinking, and I would also add addictions of various nature, it's not exclusively because of work. It could be other things, and that could be a relationship that goes both ways, in my opinion.
I think my take on fear is that fear is more of an effect than a factor directly. So when I look at the hygiene factors, what are some of the things in which could inject fear or create conditions by which somebody is fearful? Job security would be one, for sure. If you don't have job security, then you're going to fear anything coming down from higher. That's going to be a natural reaction. Interpersonal relationships, which could be peers or superiors, like, for example, one's fear could be just simply enhanced by a toxic working environment with a particular manager or a particular peer leader who's sort of a domineering personality that can create conditions by which everybody hates to be around that person, but they depend on that person for some reason because that person has, particular power. I think some of it is captured. I do agree that not all of it is captured easily, because like with DEI, as an example, where some things can be both motivating and hygiene, I think about individuals who are working, for example, specifically in the diversity, equity, and inclusion administration offices. They would see the program as their motivator, and that achievement in terms of some forward momentum of some particular factor to them would be achievement, would be recognition. And so for them specifically, it would be motivating. Whereas for other parts of the organization, it would be more hygiene. It would be something that represents something to eliminate in order to create conditions for achievement elsewhere. And so in some ways, I can see where some of these might chain, where one person's hygiene is another person's motivator. Then that person's hygiene is somebody else's motivator, especially if you're going along functions within the organization that go move further and further away from the core mission of the organization. What do hospitals frequently, hospital workers frequently complain about? A lot of it has to do with stuff that has nothing to do with medicine. But of course, in order for a hospital to run effectively, it has to have all of these other professionals in it doing particular jobs that to the frontline workers are hygiene factors. But to them, those other professionals are highly important and are interdependent with each other. So then it's not just a matter of balancing one set of factors from one perspective. It actually turns into a rather complex terrain of what motivates different segments, and to figure out how to balance, if balance is the right word, all of these factors that affect different parts of the organization differently.
And there's the interrelationship between the different factors as well that affects people, doesn't it? There's a good table about the interrelationship of factors in the lows on page 75, looking at all the different motivators and when they're interrelated in the lows with the hygiene factors, what the, you know, the level of, I guess, impact is from those. Interesting that salary is with company policy administration, interpersonal relationships and supervisors with supervision, technical as it's called as well. And then the lower end of the scale is interpersonal relationships and peers with company policy and administration. The other thing I was thinking about in terms of motivators as well is there wasn't mention of power and influence when, you know, that can be one of the reasons for why people are motivated. And I think we saw that very clearly in our episode on Dalton and men who manage. There was a lot of men working in the factory who, on the face of it, didn't have a lot of power or influence if you were just to look at what their job was. But through them creating their own alternative world of power, basically, within the organization, when they tried to bureaucratize it in terms of controlling them, you know, this indulgency pattern beforehand and afterwards when they bureaucratized it, you know, you really see very clearly that it was obviously motivating for people who weren't doing fantastic jobs, or their jobs had changed and they weren't very inspiring jobs. Power gave them social status and must have been a motivator. And I'm sure it is for lots of people still as well. I was just wondering what you thought about that as a motivator.
I had thought of it actually within the status element as a sort of consequence or interpretation of the status, or a more pragmatic, what does this status actually imply? Well, I've got power, so, you know, maybe it was my overprojection. I thought that it would sit there. But perhaps you actually make a very valid point that it is such an important element, and it's not necessarily always coupled with status, that it should be unpacked.
And as a motivator, it's a hard one to measure, actually.
Well, yeah, because you would have sort of the more formalized element, but also the more informal, which is even trickier to grasp.
To measure, yeah.
That may also be a factor of the sample, because when you're talking about these sort of professionals, recognition and achievement, I think, are very, very closely coupled with power, whereas in, you know, folks who are in sales or some other part of the organization would perceive power as a little bit more of a factor unto itself, perhaps. I agree. Supervision technical was also listed as a factor in the table, and that might also be kind of, It's like they sort of worked around it because it didn't come up explicitly from this particular sample. But yeah, you would think it would.
An additional topic that I would like to add that I feel is missing and is quite important today is this idea of purpose or mission. So Tom did actually mention it quite cleverly, talking about hospitals and the closeness to the mission. And obviously for hospitals, it's quite easy to make that connection. If you think about social entrepreneurs, the reasons why they embark on that journey, or even people who actually choose to go and work with them, it is around that mission, or even charity NGOs. So obviously the sample and the companies that were studied, both in the pilot and in the major study, were very, very different. But I'm thinking that if we were to talk about today's landscape in terms of business landscape, this is an important part that is missing.
I would agree. Now, what it may do is it might cause us to rethink what some of these first level factors like achievement, what they really mean, and recognition. So it'd probably be one of those where, again, the character of the factor may change. The nature of it might be relatively consistent. But recognition would seem, in those particular instances where your ability to play in that field is heavily dependent on recognition, and not necessarily good recognition either, right? Just being a name brand would seem to be strong and therefore at least superficially consistent with what Hertzberg found. What would be different, perhaps, would be a lot of the hygiene factors, because the hygiene factors in this particular study are endemic of large organizations. What would it be as a social entrepreneur or some other, some other innovator where you're dealing with a very, very small organization and you're using force of personality? It might be hygiene factors that are external to the organization, such as the pain of raising capital or something else. You know, it just might be a different set of hygiene factors.
Yeah, in certain settings, if you're an entrepreneur, are the hygiene factors as critical? So, you know, if you're just one individual rather than in a big company, are they as critical as the motivators? Possibly not.
Possibly not. In the public sector, you might even have a whole different scheme altogether, because their hygiene factors become really, really important. And this is a gross oversimplification, because obviously, you know, public sector employees are very hardworking people and they're very proud of the work they do for the public. But a lot of what they do in a bureaucratic sense is there isn't always the same capability to do something wildly innovative or achievement and recognition would be something that would be more exceptional than it might be in some other settings. And so then, you know, how does the leadership provide the ability to recognize or to motivate employees who really are in jobs that it's not changing very much? There's not much variation in what they do. How to motivate would be really hard. And the impact of hygiene factors would be that much more significant, because the dissatisfiers would seem to accumulate faster in those sorts of settings. But the other thing then is also, is it easier to address hygiene factors, or is it, like sometimes, I think even in Hertzberg, there were some examples of this where it was sort of like the organization senses a problem and their first instinct is to go after hygiene factors because it's simpler and they think they can accomplish something by it. Like, let's raise pay or let's...
I was just for the sake of discussion, because we're in a friendly space. We've talked a lot about this work and also quite a lot of the others from a managerial perspective, because that's the aim with which it was set out. That's the perspective that is adopted, and that is perhaps the most evident or straightforward implications. But thinking a little bit about today's workplace, where a lot of organizations have got flat structures, a lot of organizations are micro or freelancers, a lot of people consider themselves their own organization and to a certain extent dictate their own rules. And we haven't really mentioned about quiet quitting, which is the latest trend. And I think it's something interesting to think about in relation to Hertzberg's factors. But what I wanted to get to was, can this work tell us about, and as workers or organizations, as, and I think there might be some important lessons there. What it speaks to me about from a worker perspective is really the importance of perhaps drawing boundaries, perhaps speaking up when certain things don't work, and kind of bringing the worker back into that picture of, well, yeah, the hygiene factors not really there, the motivation, and just kind of perhaps trying to tweak a little bit more the dialogue. That's something that I would perhaps take away.
I think we're saying as well that even though this isn't perfect by any manner of means, and we are focusing, I guess, on critiquing it to a certain extent by the nature of what we're doing here, you know, it's not a bad start, is it, in 1959, when nothing else like this probably existed. And if most practitioners were to follow, even with its issues, a lot of its basic principles now, and tweak it maybe for modern times, it is a useful management tool, you know, and it has applicability definitely to probably giving you a happier and more productive worker, which is the aim of the research in the first place.
There is something else, though, that kind of take away. I am interested in what do you actually do? Because trying to enhance the motivating factors, very, very easy to say, very, very difficult to do. It does speak to me that in a lot of ways that sometimes we still kind of conflate satisfiers and dissatisfiers and treat them as if we solve the dissatisfaction problem and we will get satisfaction. We will improve worker satisfaction. And part of it is because I do think that addressing hygiene is simpler, not necessarily easy. Definitely not easy if we're talking, going back to our DIEB. But, you know, it's something that an organization can take an action with the intention of addressing a hygiene factor, declare that they're doing something, regardless of whether or not it actually does anything. And then go back to concentrating on what they consider to be really salient, which is performance and achievement. Because this is one of the things that I think organizations do struggle with, is that they recognize the importance of the hygiene factors, but it's not what they are necessarily in business for in the first place, or at least they don't necessarily see it that way. And so it's hard, I think, even for those who really want to have the best environment. The competitiveness of the environment means that organizations have to concentrate on their bottom line, whatever kind of organization that is, whether it is the balance sheet or whether it's the ability to provide public services or if it's something else, deliver on a new innovation if you're talking about entrepreneurship. Because the satisfiers and the dissatisfiers are disconnected requires two different pockets of energy. What do you want to do to increase energy in one pot and optimize the energy put in the other pot? Unfortunately, I go back to the example we did in the documentary American Factory, and the answer was use robots and take the humans out of the equation. You know, it's a tough challenge. In a perfect world, we would not require. I mean, what you'd really want is you'd want organizations to be in a position where they really don't have to devote exceptional amounts of energy and the hygiene factors, that the things that the dissatisfiers would be removed based on the climate of the organization, which is really idealistic, you know?
I think a lot of companies try to do that by having a HR department for the hygiene factors and think that's not going to take away from company time if we give this to HR to deal with all of the hygiene factors. And then I think it's the managers who are responsible for the motivation and the motivators, you know, to help people feel a sense of achievement, recognition, to look at the job itself and the job design and, you know, giving people levels of responsibility and autonomy, advancement and growth, you know, that is the manager. So in a way, in my mind, I kind of think how it is applied in the real world is very much the hygiene factors. I'm not saying it's the right way. Seem to be looked after if you're big enough to have a HR department. Lots of people aren't. They're their own company. Is looked after by the HR department, and the motivators are looked after by the managers.
I would also add that in the case of professions that can be unionized, there's that additional level of control or sort of check in with the hygiene factors, which is obviously of not all professions, which is something really important and creates a lot of inequality from that perspective.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. When we talk about addressing hygiene factors, regardless of whether you do it inside the organization or through, say, a third party or like a union or whatever, there is that other part of me that wonders, is it better to have them addressed in a programmatic fashion or to have them more organic? The reason why I ask that is because sometimes when it comes to hygiene factors, the tendency is to respond in a programmatic fashion. You establish a dedicated office to it, dedicated resources, dedicated training time, to which it can feel like it's separate and distinct from the work as opposed to integrated with the work. And it always kind of struck me as I'm looking at the sorts of things that they listed as the hygiene factors, that many of them are things that should be addressed organically. It's something that the members of the organization should work out among themselves rather than create a bureaucracy to drive it. Of course, the reason why we have the bureaucracy to drive it is because it doesn't work organically all the time. So it's almost paradoxical, isn't it?
I believe as he did lots of studies after this one as well, and applied it, it did evolve in the years after this, and there's different categories and stuff, but I haven't read Work in the Nature of Man yet.
Yeah, but I do want to get back to the point about quiet quitting and the more contemporary issues, because that almost strikes me as kind of like a systemic response to a systemic inability, and I'm not sure what I mean by system, a systemic inability to properly balance motivators from hygiene. It was, with the pandemic, there just seems to be a certain amount of cynicism over an organization's ability to care for people's needs, and therefore it seemed like we're mired at the moment. I don't know.
I think when trends like quiet quitting become so widespread, there is a systemic problem. I agree with that. Not sure entirely where it stems from and sort of where it's going. But I do think that there is value to collectively people reacting and tracing boundaries again. I think we've got to a period of complete frenziness where work boundaries, and still some industries are very poor at tracing them. And I think expecting managers or organizations to realize that it's too much, unfortunately, there's a level of sensitivity or attention, let's call it that, where you only realize it's too much when people burn out, when it's too late to a certain extent, or when they've gone, they've moved on, they've done other stuff. So I think it's a powerful indicator of bringing back, what is actually work within a more holistic view of life. I don't know if the pandemic just put the magnifying glass on it or induced people to reflect, or the people that weren't furloughed, unemployed, were actually overworked because of the sort of the various things that we know related to working from home, but also having the kids jumping from one Zoom to the next. So I'm not really sure. It was probably just the perfect storm of things, and this is the reaction. So that's kind of how I would interpret it.
I think as well, I'm sure there are studies that are going on at the moment as we speak, looking at motivation post-pandemic, because the elephant in the room, I find sometimes, is the fact that everybody has actually been through a trauma. And, for the people that have continued working and stayed working throughout it, or have been furloughed and came back, or lost their jobs and are looking for jobs or don't have jobs, everybody has gone through, a huge crisis where they felt their lives and the people around them's lives were under severe threat, and they didn't know when that was going to end. And we've had to kind of just get back on the horse and keep going, like as if none of this really happened. And isn't it great? Because we're all still here. Some of us are anyway. And I don't think that's recognized. And I think human beings being human beings, and I'm not a psychologist, I don't have the background in it, this is going to turn up somewhere down the line. And I think it's not surprising that, you know, we have things like quiet quitting or, you know, people evaluating their work-life balance in the UK as well. There's a big focus on the four-day week, maybe the same in the US as well, and how we can make that work. And there's been a lot of research done into that recently as the answer to all our ills, the four-day week. But, you know, I think that isn't recognised, that that has affected people's motivation, even the most motivated of people. There has been an impact, but we're expected to just kind of keep on keeping on and be grateful that, that we're all here. And I don't think as human beings, we're as simple as that, really.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And what you bring up kind of reminds me of one other factor that just seems to be missing from the study. And, it, you know, again, it's not anybody's fault. It's just what they looked at. Predictability, reliability, stability. Job security is only a tiny sliver of that. But predictability, reliability, and stability cover three different parts of what constitute sufficient continuity in one's place in both the organization and society that allows for the elimination of dissatisfiers and enables the ability for one to achieve. I mean, what you're getting at reinforces in my mind that as much as our organizations may see performance and achievement as being the centerpiece of what they do, dissatisfiers are far more powerful, I think, than satisfiers. And dissatisfiers, I think, have disproportionately longer tail effects than I think that the Hertzberg study showed, simply out of the fact that trauma is just, regardless of what kind of trauma we're talking about, it has lasting effects. It really discolors what you find to be acceptable in the circumstances of the environment moving forward. It's something you carry with you in ways perhaps that you might not do so with the great achievements that you have. It means that the future work environments are going to have to address hygiene factors more than they would like, just simply because it is that much of it has that much of an impact. I don't know how long it's going to be for us to feel the immediate effects, you know, the effects of the pandemic and what it put the magnifying glass on. But I think it's going to be a while. You know, people are going to try to go back to the previous status quo, but it's just not going to be possible. I think people are really looking at things much differently than they were a few years ago. And I think that's going to carry for quite some time.
I just wonder, do we need to talk a bit about motivation theories in organization theory and where this sits within them? You know, a little bit about how this is kind of at the turning point from scientific management to the HR movement, just a bit of the context of that. And then, you know, everything that came after that. Well, we can't do it all today, obviously, but, you know, I was thinking about, as we were talking about, where this sits in the wonderful jazz canon, as Pedro once said, of organization studies and organization theory. And I guess it is at the juncture where the focus went from scientific management much more onto the HR question, how to motivate employees. And this is one of the first publications, I guess, which could be, you know, said to be from the HR movement. Many of the motivation theories as well were grounded in psychology at that time, starting with Maslow, of course. However, you know, there has been some critique of the narrative that, you know, this is the story that we tell of organization studies and how it has evolved very neatly from scientific management to the HR movement, as if nobody ever focused on people before and people only ever focused on scientific management previously. But perhaps as well, you know, it cuts out the opportunity to talk about, you know, some other theories that have been around, I guess, a bit more from the critical perspective, such as Marxist theory, where you can say that, you know, there'll never be a motivation, will always be a struggle within a capitalist society and work environment. And also, where is the motivation that comes from being constantly monitored, which is perhaps a more modern view of work, which we touched on earlier as well. And we saw, I guess, that in scientific management, well, scientific management was challenged in through the HR movement that a happy worker was also a productive worker. As the theory before was that money always motivates. And I guess we see through this that money, if our salary, I guess, or wages, if absent, are not equitable, are a dissatisfier. And actually, in terms of motivation, their impact probably depends on the circumstance and the individual, how much of a motivation they are.
Well, I think that one of the things that this speaks to is what are ultimately the levers that managers have available to them? I can liken it to a cockpit of an airplane with a whole bunch of different controls that each could have some impact on the satisfaction or dissatisfaction of employees. And the managers are left with trying to figure out which combination of flipping switches and turning dials would achieve the desired effect to either tamp down a brewing situation or to help inject a little bit of innovation into the workplace or whatever. Because just like with flying of an airplane, it is so context dependent but when you flip a switch, it can have a different impact depending on where you are. That's always the struggle for the manager, which is why, in a way, again, going back to that HBR article, that recent one, it doesn't surprise me that managers perhaps see things through rose-colored glasses, in that particular survey. Because here it is, they're flipping switches that they think is going to have the right effect. The plane isn't crashing into the ground. It is a challenge to have an accurate running picture of what's going on and what impact that what people are doing is having on how people feel about the organization. And over time, it's hard to imagine that cynicism of some sort wouldn't brew up in parts of the organization regardless. What are the levers would seem to be like one of the things that we'd want to know. And what are the costs and benefits of pulling those levers so that we don't just resort to the easy solution, throw money at the problem?
Definitely. I think some of the best managers I've worked for and worked with and seen in action are able to take a bespoke approach to the motivation, and they cover the hygiene factors as best they can, and they respond quickly and responsively to any of the hygiene factors not being addressed. Speed is really important with hygiene factors sometimes, and it's hard in very big bureaucratic organizations to do that. And the motivators, depending on the type of work you do in the context, if I'm just thinking of the world that I inhabit myself, taking a bespoke approach to individuals in terms of their motivations, because I do think it is quite individual. I think there are general trends and there are general things that we know inspire people in certain professions probably to do. You know, that they're aspiring for recognition, they're aspiring for achievement. But also, what motivates people on an individual level can be very personal to them. And I think, good management is about getting to know your employees and getting to know what are the things that are going to motivate them so that, you can retain them and that they can achieve for themselves and for the company or the organization that they work for. And I think if all else fails as a manager, I still go back to what he said at the start of the book, which is, at the end of the day, just focus on keeping the same people sane. I'm going to make a poster of that.
Well, it was nice to finish on my favourite catchphrase. So I don't know if I should. I feel like I've ruined the ending. I like that catchphrase. I'll paint it on the walls. I'll graffiti it. If you see random graffiti. But building on Catherine's experience, I think also from a managerial perspective, when the hygiene factors aren't in place and when perhaps there are difficulties or challenges in particular in organizations that are, just difficult to navigate, at least the acknowledgement of them, I think, is important, because we talk a lot about motivation, but perhaps the value of Hertzberg's work is around that baseline, the importance, and as Tom correctly pointed out, the fact that they are the most challenging to put in place. So I think the acknowledgement is really important, and obviously within today's increasingly complex workforce picture, then the diversity elements that also create further nuances, those would be my key takeaways from this book. Thank you.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.